Well, where we left off in the middle of things last time, Brunhilde had just been confronted by Wotan and given orders this time to kill Sigmund and save Hunding, even though Wotan wanted it the other way around. Then he has to talk to Brunhilde. And he says, "I am caught in fetters of my own making, I least free of all living." And this is a really interesting conception, because one would think that the gods were completely free beings. But it turns out to be really not the case, because the gods, not only Wotan, he just represents all of the gods, are bound by law. In a way, they in their evolution did not have the freedom, or did not take the freedom of rebellion, to become outsiders to things, and they are now completely locked into the law. And in another way, they're very reasonable creatures. And when they're reasonable creatures, they live off of divine love, like the apples of Freya. And when you live off of that love, that is the essence of your creation. And all of the gods are creative beings, and they sustain the universe by their creative activity. But then they become prisoners of their own love, and the love manifests in logical, reasonable, you might say, law-abiding ways. And so Wotan is in that kind of position. And something happens in this opera that a lot of people don't understand. But Wotan tells the whole story all over again. That is the story that was covered in the Rhine Maidens and in the early part of this story. And some people consider it a very great waste. I think it has not so much to do with the need for repetition, but for the fact that this opera was written before the Rheingold, and he did this thinking that he was never going to write the Rheingold. And so he had this as background information, because otherwise what was transpiring was just too loose and wasn't all tied together. At any rate, he tells the whole big story, and it takes an enormous part of the play, and it's almost a one big long solo with a few little chippings in by Brunhilde. And then he makes a statement about his part. "From him I should be obliged to wrest the ring that I myself had paid him as toll, but I may not touch one with whom I have struck a bargain. Powerless before him, my metal would succumb. These are the bonds that bind me. I, who am master through treaties, to my own treaties am now a slave. One person might do what I may not, a hero whom I never stooped to help, who, a stranger to the god, free of his favor, instinctively unbidden of his own need, with his own weapon, might do the deed I must shun." So another statement. It's something we've talked about before when we talked about Heracles. Oaths. It states it very poetically, very clearly, very concisely. When you have made a bargain, and the more clearly that bargain is defined, the more your plans are, the more things have been laid out with exactitude, and you have put your consciousness to them and live in them, the more you are bound, the more you are limited. It takes a very great sense of composition to know how much planning to do, how much exact commitment to make, how many treaties, how many oaths and such like that one should make. Because if one makes too many, then one will have a very weak life, because of being bound by those treaties and not being allowed to go outside of those treaties, one can't gain full experience. On the other hand, if there are no oaths at all, if there are no plans, if there are no treaties, then there is no solid buffer between oneself and experience. There is no point, no reference point to measure from, no solidity of character, and one equally is weakened from experience. And it's one of those things, I don't know that one can put down a formula and say this much or this kind of thing should be planned ahead and committed to, and this much or this kind of thing should not. It's a difficult one. I find that I actually plan less all the time, and I find myself much more adaptable to conditions and much more open to new outlooks. But on the other hand, I've perhaps been overly protective of myself in the kinds of commitments that I've made to my life anyway. And he goes on in telling about all of his woes, and he starts talking about the hero again, which was just alluded to where we broke off. The other whom I so long for, that other shall never find for the... shall I never find, for the free man must create himself. I can only fashion slaves. This is interesting. It states the human condition. Our condition is that in order to be saviors of ourselves or to redeem ourselves and to be saviors of the cosmos, it means that we must recognize and fully live out our rebellious condition, our sinful condition, where we are separated from the cosmos, and in that we find our freedom. We're not so free from the cosmos that our causes don't come to consequences, and that the food of them, the essence or experience of our causes, our actions and such, are indeed nutrition for the cosmos. And everything we do eventually brings us back in, because it's a closed system that we work in. It's more that our freedom is that our creation is outside of the strict plan. But the point, whether we had fallen or not, the whole idea is that anything that is created and that is created too strictly, here we see what we have just been talking about, like a planned life being a life that is devoid of spontaneity and creative fluidity and the experience of things in new and different ways. That means that such a life, also the creations of that kind of a life, are too restrictive. That were it to be the case that we were completely controlled in every aspect of our life, we would be automatons. We would be machines of some kind or another, and there would be no possibility for creative activity in us. So what happens is, in order to be free, there has to be an allowing at least for the possibility of mistakes, at least for the possibility of failure, at least for the possibility of working outside of the plan, because if that is not built in, if there is no opening, then there is no room for creation in the object that is created, or in the being that is created, and that is for ourselves also. We have to realize that we as beginning creators, because we come from this place of very great freedom, we ourselves can create really unique beings in the same way that limitation begets limitation, and in the same way that error can beget error. We, by our very great special outsider status, we can bequeath the cosmos generations which will develop into other generations of creative beings that are as free as we have the potential to be. So he continues on telling the whole story, and he starts telling about the ring. And he talks about he himself being contaminated by the ring, even though the ring was made by humans. He says, "I have touched Albrecht's ring. I clung avidly to the gold. The curse I fled from does not now fly from me. What I love, I must forsake. Kill what I most hold dear. Deceitfully betray him who trusts me." He's alluding in this case to Sigmund. And this is a great problem of selfhood. It means, we're back at that whole problem. It's going to come up again and again in these talks on the ring. This means that the more we defend, or the more we cling to our selfhood, and by our consciousness define our individuality by holding a selfhood to us and acquiring things to us, not even if they're only material things, but as well thoughts and ideas and experiences and outlooks on the cosmos, that whole attitude of acquiring and holding our selfhood and the egoism and selfishness that is involved in that contaminates things. Because by self-assertion, then, anything that cannot live in us, by and through us, must die. Our creations must be separated from us, because if we don't separate them from us, they're going to separate themselves from us in a kind of deathly sacrifice. And Wotan goes on to say, "I learned of late tidings of the Nibelung that the dwarf has mastered a woman whose favors he gained by gold." This is going to be coming up again. "A woman is carrying the fruit of hate. The force of envy stirs in her womb. This wonder befell the loveless one, yet of her I courted loving, I did not beget my free being." Meaning to say that Albrecht is somewhere, Albrecht being the Atlantean kind of human being, or perhaps even earlier, the Lemurian type of being, the original fallen one beneath the mist who developed the self, that same one under the tutelage of the Lucifers created sin, which gave us freedom. That same one now is again influenced and is producing something like an Antichrist. This is a forethought to things that are coming up in future operas. Wagner is very wise in that way, and he understands full well the mythical concept of time. Because if the myths live in the spiritual worlds, then in the spiritual worlds there is, relative to this world, a timelessness. Past and present are all one because the consciousness is so intense and it permeates both directions of time, and cause and consequence are seen in a whole. And so as a result, Wagner is speaking through Wotan, has Wotan discovering the future. So the price of freedom is a fall into sin, and what is commented on here is that sin itself propagates more sin. We've talked about that before, about how the sin of Adam and Eve, the selfish use of the creative energy for procreation and for lust, how that produced the second sin, the sin of Cain, the sin of murder. And now this is propagated in a desire fighting for power of the cosmos, only in this case it is through an Antichrist type of being that at least in vengeance will try to stand against the gods by bringing someone into the world who will fight against the gods. Wotan and Brunhilde struggle about this new order that he has given to her. And it's a very interesting dialogue they have, but it goes to show that if Wotan represents the chief of the gods and the truth spirit Brunhilde represents something like an individuality within him, that in the same way that we struggle between self and ego, between higher nature and lower nature, this is propagated also into the gods. That once there is an individuality created and it has been tainted by the conception of self in isolation or self and separated, there is a struggle. It's a natural consequence once there is a division between two points of view, two centers of being. We're at the principle of distribution again, which we won't go into much right now because it's going to come up later on in the next opera. But the fact that there are two points of view, there would be no opera, there would be no converse between Wotan and Brunhilde unless that division was there. And it's a very important thing. Without any difference of point of view, without any separative kind of experience, there would be no new experience at all. Masterfully, at this point, what occurs is that as there is this struggle between Wotan and Brunhilde, the struggle comes back to the humans. And at this point, Sigmund and Sieglinde appear, and they're running from Sieglinde's husband. And Sieglinde is struggling within herself. On one hand, she is passionately in love with Sigmund, and it is her destiny and it is her being to be receptive to him. On the other hand, she struggles with herself as sort of being another Eve again. She hates herself because she feels she's defiled herself, she's defiled Sigmund, and she has defiled the law. She's taking this all very personally, because if we remember, the feminine usually, but doesn't have to, but it usually represents the material, the passive receptive. Now, in that, we don't mean to say that somebody who was born as a woman represents matter and all that sort of thing, because the individuality can be born in either kind of body and, in fact, is born in either kind of body. But when one is in the feminine body, one has to deal with that inner conflict about the gender separation. When we're in that kind of body, we represent the interaction with the ultimate feminine, the absolute. And the absolute is the tempting feminine. It is what has the effect on the spiritual masculine to become even more, to express itself by extending itself into the unknown. And this is a great temptation. It is, the woman represents that, and she also represents the congealment of that as the unknown, as ignorance, as brute matter. And if these qualities are personalized, if the ideal of the cosmos is light, more light, if it is truth, more truth, if it is love, more love, and the woman represents the interface with the absolute, which represents the resistance to this activity, as well as the ultimate source for everything that is becoming new light and love and truth. If one takes that personally, then one feels like one is standing against the whole process of everything. It's not hard to see how people who take it personally now, being in a feminine body, don't like being called or being designated by that merely alone, because they're identifying with the woman's body, not realizing that in spirit they can be either male or female. One can see how they feel uncomfortable about things. In the masculine body, on the other hand, the character of men is very much like the character of spirit. It is almost unconscionably positive. It's carried away in its own work, doing its own thing in Hamlet-like fashion, and it's unified, whereas the feminine is uncomfortably receptive, and it's at the fringes, the buffer between the known and the unknown. Now, the interesting thing is that ultimately, the absolute is untouched by the spirit, meaning to say, exactly as the Bible verse says, "And the light shined in darkness, and the darkness knew it not." Meaning to say that the darkness doesn't care how much of it gets lit up, because in its own absolute being, it's still all unchanged. And in this, because it to itself doesn't struggle, the struggle is a result of the energy being projected from the masculine spirit, rebounding or congealing itself or resisting itself through the creative make-believe in the cosmos, the absolute wins by losing. In fact, it never loses, and there's never any possibility of losing. It must create, and it must give out, or it must give forth, and it doesn't make any difference to it. However, the masculine, it attains to its new light, but it's almost like a fire that burns itself out when the fuel is spent. That is to say, the absolute goes on untrammeled altogether, whether it is in the great sleep between creations or whether it is in the creation itself. The absolute is ever untouched. However, in the experience of the absolute, the potential that becomes actual within it, that we call cosmos, and that which we call God, it has its limits. And so just in the same way that in the masculine personality there is a tendency for it to do its thing until it burns itself out, and in a very childlike way, how would you say, burns its candle until there is no candle left, the same is true in a cosmic sense. But on the other hand, it is guilt-free. It, because of its positivity, it burns clean. It burns up everything, and it is freed from guilt. However, if there is a waking conscious association with the absolute and with the curiosity in the form of temptation, that is a difficult position to be in. But anyway, Brunhilde appears now to Sigmund. She makes herself visible, and she appears to Sigmund as the angel of death. She's no longer just an angel, but she's the angel of death. And she gives him a glorious promise. She says, I'm going to take you to a wondrous land, a land where you will live forever and you'll be with other people who are heroes. And this is a statement that all students of the mysteries would love, because everybody from Socrates to Don Juan has always said that death is our best friend, because it is the proving of what in this world of limitations, in this world of darkness and ignorance, whether we really know what we know and whether what we have to offer is really worthwhile. And it's what keeps us honest, because we realize that we have only so much time here, and people who are afraid of death are people who are afraid of how they have spent their time here, or misspent it, or didn't spend it at all. Just let it fly right by them. They realize that somehow this is a tremendous opportunity to do something, and the proof of that doing will come when the causes are dissolved back into a realm where cause and consequence reunite in a total whole oneness, and the truths will be understood at that point. So what Brunhilde is doing is she's inviting him to a world of universals, from a world of particulars where he will, wherein he now struggles and fears and has pain. Remember, he called himself child of woe, and then he called himself man without freedom. But at any rate, she invites him to Valhalla, and she tells him how wonderful and glorious it is. And he says, sure, when will Sieglinde and I be getting there? And Brunhilde, being the spirit of truth, has to tell him, no, she's not going. She's going to stay here for a while. She's got more suffering to do yet. And Sigmund, he has the character of a becoming hero. He hasn't quite completely made it yet. We saw that in the last act, because he sold out the creative energy in what he thought was love, but was just another expression of passion again. But at any rate, he has this staunch character of a becoming hero, and he cannot be persuaded, cajoled, threatened, begged, or anything to go to Valhalla. He said, I'm just not going, because I am going to be with Sieglinde, because she is my destiny. Brunhilde persists. But the more she persists in trying to persuade him, the more she loves him. You see, the vacillation that is in Sigmund, his is due to ignorance, and his is due to desire. He indeed tries to burn the candle at both ends. He would have a life of sexual passion, and he would have a life as a spiritual hero at the same time. And you just can't do that. But now his character has radiated. Now that's the wonderful thing we have. Even though we are not complete creators yet, even in our weak state, even in our sinful state, when we're in exile here where the gods can't get at us directly, from that vantage point we do have a toehold. And from that toehold we radiate things into the universe that affect all the gods. And so the vacillation that is in Sigmund in its own way propagates to Brunhilde, but because Brunhilde is obviously innocent and virtuous, she doesn't become a creature of desire, but she has the same kind of vacillation because she's trying to persuade him as she has been told to do, but at the same time she loves him for what he is. But he remains firm. And in those Norse languages and Germanic languages, you would say he fasts. Like when you say that glue causes something to stick fast, or when you say you're on a fast, those are both the same word, and it represents a state of committed love. And so he is firm or fast in his commitment, in his love, and to Hela. And actually, the word Hela is actually used, the queen of the underworld. And he says, no. And this proves that he is indeed a hero in the making, or almost become, because even to his very last breath, even at the temptation of immortality and life with the gods and other divine creatures, he stays faithful. Because the one thing of the material world before we enter into the spiritual worlds is faithfulness. Now, Siegmund is the father of the true hero that comes in the next opera, that is Siegfried, and Siegmund represents this world. Siegfried represents the one who steps into the other realm and is a conqueror there, a conqueror in both realms. So Siegmund represents faithfulness. And so in the same way that we say that somebody draws a picture and we say that it's a faithful representation, or we say that this device is faithful to the inventor's concept, faithfulness is the test of truth in the material plane. The material plane is ruled by Saturn, and Saturn has that quality of mechanical perfection brought right down to the level of the atom. And so the step before we actually become heroes is the step of faithfulness, and Siegmund is holding true in that. And she says to him, you're a madman. And she's right, because he is divided. He's divided between the life of a hero and the life of a sexual sensualist. And our word for madmen now is schizophrenic, and that means somebody whose soul is in a state of schism. And we are divided. Moreover, he's a madman in another way, because he's filled with love. It's for love for Sieglinde that he adheres as much as he does, and he's divided between the call of heaven and the call of someone he loves, and so it's a divine kind of madness. Eventually, he wins her over, and she feels she must shield him. He's become a darling of the gods, so to speak. And at this point, Sieglinde awakens. She's been sleeping because she's in the travail of pregnancy. It's really interesting because she is asleep when the higher conversation is going on. She can't see Brunhilde. So the way Wagner represents this, that the lower part, the persona, the very physical part of our being, in this case represented by Sieglinde, has to be sleeping. And so then the action breaks out. This is the big action, the only action of the whole play. Hunding appears, and they fight. And it's a brief fight, and Siegmund has the sword Norfung, but he is about to strike a death blow, and Wotan appears, and Wotan is angry because Brunhilde has disobeyed his command, even though it was the command he didn't want to issue. And what Wotan does, just when Sigmund is striking with the sword, he interposes the ash stem taken from the world ash in between Hunding and Sigmund, and the sword splits in two, and it shatters, and what happens is with the counter blow, Hunding kills him. Now, remember, we said that a little while ago that Wotan commanded Brunhilde to take away the magical power out of the sword. Well, actually, Brunhilde didn't have to do it. That taking of the magic out of the sword was actually concluded in the last part of the first act, because when Sigmund unites with Sieglinde, when they coalesce sexually, he is now a divided man. He's no longer the pure hero. He has divided his interest between material things and gratification of his love and a completion of his love in that fashion and the divine spiritual seeking. And what he has done then is an enormous charge of his creative energy has gone out of him, and it has gone into the procreation of the child that is being carried by Sieglinde, and the other part is put upward into the, you know, because he has the ability to see Brunhilde in the spiritual worlds, and the energies are divided. And the sword obviously represents in the human being, it represents the spinal column, the spinal fire, which is the creative energy, and he literally has been burning the candle at both ends, and the fire is flaming downward and outward, as well as upward and inward, and that leaves it weak in the center, and it must shatter. And that's what happens. And what Brunhilde does at this point, she realizes she's really in trouble. She gathers up the two pieces of the sword, and she grabs Sieglinde, and she absconds with both of them, riding off, and Wotan is angry, very angry, and he vows punishment for Sieglinde, Brunhilde, because she disobeyed his order. That's the end of Act 2. We'll look at Act 3, and the next time we'll begin with Siegfried. It looks like it's going to take two talks for each of the four operas, except maybe we'll get the last one in talk. The last one is the longest in terms of time. It's an enormously long opera, but it's not very, very pithy as far as its content of spiritual information. So Act 3 opens up at a high rocky summit, and the other Valkyrie, the eight sisters of Brunhilde, they're sort of singing and cavorting on their on their horses, and the sound of their voices is very different than the sound of the Rhine maidens. The Rhine maidens have a rolling, gurgling sound that is just like water, and the sound of the Valkyries is very high-pitched and echoey. I get an inward image that is something like a cone spreading up, sort of, you know, like a bullhorn where people have that, you know, like cheerleaders use a cone like that. I get a feeling like that in the air when I hear their voices. But at any rate, they're impatient to get on with their work of taking heroes up to heaven, and they're waiting for Brunhilde, and they call for her, and from a distance you can hear her calling back. And eventually, Brunhilde comes out of the woods, and she has with her Sieglinde, and she's shielding her. And she says, "Sisters, I need help." And she starts telling them what she did, and the sisters think she's crazy, because she's already been also been infected with the division, and they'll say, "No way. Will we help you in this one?" You know, they're not the disobedient one. If we look at the sisters as the planets, other planets of the solar system, you might say that it is on Earth where that special activity of sin and rebellion took place. We might have distributed it among other humans by passing through the earthly condition, and that separative sinful state that we have, but this is the place, and that's why you might say then that in that interpretation of Brunhilde as the earth, it is all consistent. Sieglinde is in agony because she's filled with child or filling with child, and it's in the early stages of the pregnancy, so she has morning sickness and all of those kinds of things. And Brunhilde bids her to have courage in the name of motherhood. And the sisters begin to leave, and as they're leaving, they begin talking about a place to the east of where they are, where Fafnir has turned himself, Fafnir the giant, the brother of Fasolt, if you remember. It was Fafnir that killed Fasolt for the gold, and he has turned himself into a terrible dragon, and he's guarding all of the gold. It's interesting that Fafnir should be located to the east, because so many early religions oriented everything that they did to the east. That is, I think, because they were, many of the earlier religions in their spirituality were very much tainted by the Luciferic quality. They liked that whole quality of being blissed out. And the blissed out state was the way that the Luciferic beings kept humanity enchained. They kept them looking to the past, were trying exercises to go back to heaven, back to the old golden age before things were when they fell. And so then Lucifer represents the false light. And the false light, in this case, is obviously the sun. And the sun is the visible sun. It's not the invisible sun, which one would look for in the west at the opposite end of the heavens. When one is turning inward and going against the flow of everything, one looks to the west instead of to the east. And so we can see then that there is a consistency in this, that there is a connection in the same way that in the first act of this drama, because it's more of a drama than it is an opera, in the first act there was a connection between fire and the sword, the creative fire and the sword. Now there is a connection between the gold and the sword and fire and the sun and the east, meaning to say that these are all items that are basically materialistic, and they represent the outer glint of things and not the inner meaning. The outer glint of things can be an excellent symbol, but the more high-blown the symbol is, the more treacherously misleading it can be. But at any rate, Brunhilde vows to stand in there, and she's been herself encouraged, not that she wasn't peerless among her sisters in the first place. Wotan has already admitted that he loved her because she could read his inmost thoughts and he opened himself to her. But she was already peerless among her sisters, but she has been encouraged by the interaction with Sigmund, and she's willing to stand and take her dues because she knows Wotan is coming, and she gives the sword pieces to Sieglinde, and about that time Wotan comes and he is raging. And sisters that are still are on their way out meet him, and they all deny culpability and they plead for mercy for their sister, but she is not in the least afraid because she is indeed the spirit of truth and she has courage in her conviction right now. So there are two different sides to the feminine that have difficulties, and Wagner very clearly shows them in situations like this. The other sisters represent the unredeemed femininity in a way, because they are only receptive, and they are at worst, like in the case of Sieglinde, only unconscious temptresses, And so they're only receptive, but they can't take the stand of courage that Brunhilde has in her coming out of that condition. But and they also have that quality of being overly protective. If one is associating the consciousness with nature, and if one is associating that with the resistance of ignorance to becoming light, which is the divine purpose that matter has, if one associates a human consciousness to that, that resistance becomes like a protection for things human. And while there is a place in the world for caution, I don't know how much there is for protectiveness. Eventually, we have to throw off all of the things that would protect us, because all they do is limit us in the first place. But that's from speaking from a very masculine point of view and not from a nurturative feminine point of view. At any rate, Wotan scolds the sisters and tells them how the one who knew his innermost thoughts has betrayed him. And then he addresses her. At the point where things are starting to heat up now, I think there's some lovely poetry in here. I have to keep from wanting to read the whole thing through, which is not really out of... which is not really out of... out of the way at all. They're not that long if you just sit down and read them. Just to show how fearless she is, she says, "Here I am, Father, dictate my..." When people are self-important, as Wotan is, we can see he's got a save face and he's got to save all the appearances and all of that. When they get angry, then they enumerate all of their virtues and they enumerate their titles and they enumerate all of their decrees and things like that. And so he lists all of the facts and facets of her betrayal, and he hints at, or he insinuates, a punishment for her of her losing her previous activity. At this point, Brunhilde does take fright. She doesn't take fright at any punishment that would be against her person, but she does take fright at the opportunity to lose service, because that is the thing that unites us in a living way with the cosmos. Because everything in the cosmos is alive and dynamic, and it lives and it grows toward an ultimate purpose. And within that ultimate purpose, there are other goals and purposes and ends, and we discover them along the way. And working toward that, or working with that and helping that all along, is what service really is. It's what takes place along the way that counts. And Brunhilde, being the spirit of truth, knows that this being in the bloodstream of the cosmos and carrying out the nutrition of the unfolding of the creation is the essence of existence, and to hear that she's going to lose the opportunity to serve and be in things is quite a thing to her. At any rate, he banishes her from his sight and from his presence, meaning to say that if the ultimate, if the highest of the divinities is truth, and it radiates its being in truth into the cosmos, and all other beings are nourished by that light of truth and carry out their work by focusing on that central most being, the what would be called the eldest brother of us all, by focusing on that, you know, that's quite a shock to say that we're banished from his sight and from his presence. In this case, it's called the he. It's probably better to call it an it in the cosmos. But at any rate, Wotan condemns her to helpless sleep and that she must fall to a man who shall find her. Now, this is actually not a pronouncement of a personal judgment. A lot of things that are stated in scriptures or in mythologies or even in sublime poetry are stated as decrees or oaths or curses or punishments from the gods, and they're not that. We as humans, in our self-importance, try to make some of our statements be very special decrees. But what is being talked about here is that if she is indeed the individuality that is to be wed to the human state, the spiritual part of the being of the hero, this has been transpiring all along. That the threefold spirit, which was created at the end of the moon period, during, that is, the part of evolution previous, the stage of evolution previous to our human-like state, when we were animal-like. If we remember, we went first through a mineral-like condition where we were the resistant earth, and from that we developed the spiritual potential of will through resistance. Then we went through a plant-like state in what is called the sun period, the first period of the Saturn. And in that sun period, as we extended ourselves and gave as our service a vital life to the cosmos, we learned the possibility of living imagination and life in the spirit. And then in the moon period, which was the next stage of the cosmos after it had gone to sleep again, we were animal-like. And in that animal-like condition, we learned autonomous movement, being led around this way and that way by group spirits in the same way that animals are now. And from that experience of being separated from the earth in a way that plants and rocks aren't, they're always bound to the earth, in that state of separation, we understood the particularization of thought and understood individuality. At that point, the three attributes of the spirit were born: will, loving, living imagination, and separative, thoughtful individuality. Then the whole cosmos went to sleep again, and this individuality became to be associated with us as humans, and here on earth it has that entire time been falling asleep. During the entirety of the whole first half of creation, we as spiritual beings have been falling more and more and more asleep. So the decree of Wotan is not just a curse, and it is a statement of the way things are. And it's called a helpless sleep because in a way we as personal individuals walking around until the spirit is really within us and really becomes an awakened power, we're free from the gods, but we're sort of helpless creatures, subject to all kinds of temptations and things like that. So it really is a helpless sleep from the viewpoint of the spirit. Off in the distance, the sisters are twittering at the thought of her having to be united with a man. And then Wotan begins to sermonize, and he sends them off, and he says, don't come back for Brunhilde she's off, she's in a different category. Maybe it does represent that the people of the earth are a different category from all the rest of the people of the earth, all the rest of the people of our life wave associated with other planets. But at any rate, Brunhilde, it is her time to respond, because even in the court of the gods, and even if things are being proclaimed to you by Wotan, you get your say. She starts at first timidly, but she builds up steam. And the essence of what she says is, what did I do that was so wrong? What did I do that was so wrong? This almost is an echo of what Wotan was using when he was arguing with Fricka. And he said, what's born of love, let's let it have its way. Let's let it be something new. But this is, in Wotan's case, even though there was a deep spiritual principle involved, he was using it more as an argument in defense. But in Brunhilde's case, it's something different. Brunhilde represents that state when we in the spirit act for the good, and because we have the flow of spirit in us, and we have the intuitive knowing of what we're doing, we don't have to question what we're doing. We're undivided. We can just go ahead and do it. You know, there's no room for hesitancy. But at any rate, Wotan wants to bicker. And so he parries back, and they parry back and forth on what was his real command. The first command that he gave, or the one that he gave after Fricka laid the law down. And Wotan resorts to his frailty, or in his frailty, he resorts to taking affront at her impertinence. And what we see here is, in a way, Brunhilde represents the heart of the truth. Not just the thought, not just the mind of the truth. And what we see here then is the inner struggle being enacted all over again, only on a completely transcendental level. She said she had both love and admiration for Sigmund, and shame at herself and her decree, saying that when she did what she did it because she loved him, because he was good to love and protect, and she did it because she felt ashamed at being asked to take the life of a true hero, which she just couldn't bring herself to do that. And the argument goes back and forth, and I have a few things here that I'd like to read. As we go on, we're going to find me reading more all the time, if I can find the place here. I'll just read a little out of the whole sin. So you did what I would gladly have done. This is Wotan speaking. But what a twofold trouble compelled me not to do. Did you think the joy of love was so easily won when burning grief broke into my heart, when terrible anguish roused my wrath for love of a world to suppress the spring of love in my tormented heart? When against myself I had turned in my torment out of painful weakness, rose up in rage the burning desire of desperate longing, produced in me the frightful intent to end my eternal affliction, the wreckage of my own world. Then you enjoyed blissful pleasure in the sensuous ecstasy of delightful emotion. Laughing, you drank love's draught, while for me the corroding bitterness was the divine divine tribulation was mixed. So here he admits his divided quality, something that he loved more than almost anything else in his creation, and he had to destroy it And because she wouldn't follow his command, he claims then that she drank in the pleasure of living in his love, but not in the torment of duty, which is sort of passing the blame, is what he's trying to do. It also indicates that this kind of division, I don't know how to say this, because the divine, because the one wills and draws from itself and all of its past experience, all of its soul power, it gives everything it has to a creation. But it knows that that creation can't last ultimately, internally, but that it must fall asleep back into the absolute again. And so built right into the creative thought is the conception of the dissolution of it as the soul power wears out and the withdrawal of the new soul power from the experience gained with the interaction with matter in the process of creation. So what Wotan, in a way, is describing is something like if we had built something very, very beautiful and then had to destroy that. If we had built a musical instrument, a guitar to play music, and then needed the wood for fire and had to burn our own creation, that this produces an internal dichotomy, that within the statement of a creative assertion is the same division that precedes it, the Hamlet-like indecision, the dividedness of to be or not to be. Even in the being, even in the to be, there must be that dividedness in having to dissolve your creation. It is that very thing that becomes the soul of the creation, and it is that very thing that results in the sacrifice that purges even Wotan, or in the case of the cosmos, even the supreme being from self-association or self-attachment to its own creation, and it is that very thing that makes future creations possible. I don't know that I'm hitting exactly on this principle, but it's like saying doing something, even though it must come to an end, and even though for it to be a whole complete cycle, it must dissolve and go into decadence, that means it has to have something of destruction within it. And that means that even within this unity, there is a dichotomy, and that dichotomy in its own way thoroughly permeates even the unity, and it means that once creation has begun, it will begin again and again and again, because it then becomes an eternal wheel that gets set spinning. It's like saying that the same kind of inner division that we have, be it writer's block or whether we will marry and have children, the same kind of struggles that we have like that are the result of a dichotomy, a division of self, which is a weakness that ultimately is the downfall, but it is what makes the creative make-believe possible, and it is self-sowing for all new creations. I don't know how to say it any other way, but this is a very, very deep spiritual principle, and if we can remember that any time that we're at one extreme or the other of a creative cycle, that there is an opposite side, and that opposite side is going to be the engine in its weakness to the current state of existence, is going to be the engine that keeps this turning and keeps the creative work going on again and again and again, even if there are intermittencies, it is the most healthy kind of dose of medicine that we can get to remain pure and to remain unselfish in creative activity, or to be true creators. She, knowing the truth about himself and herself, says he can't destroy part of his immortal self. So even if they must part, he cannot completely shame and dishonor himself through her, implying that he is doing that to some extent. Actually, it's the same with us, only we are immortal, and we also cannot ultimately be destroyed. But ultimately, also looking from the bottom up now, in the same way that the effect of our sin propagates in its own way and permeates into the spirit, in the same way that the ring has contaminated Wotan, not in a sinful way, but in its own way, it's weakened Wotan. In that same way, it's beautiful to know that our deeds, sinful, imperfect, and as base as they may be, cannot ultimately dishonor the immortal self. He tells her that she has cast her lot with humans, and now she must be bound to one. She says he must be a worthy human, though. And he said, Wotan says, I can't do the choosing. And she said he produced the noble lineage of wolf sons. And he says, don't mention them now, because the envy of Fricka, I have had to destroy them. And she tells him, don't worry about that. Siglinda, the broken sword bearer, also bears the lineage, meaning to say that the son of the Walla, the Wellsung, that line is going to continue on. He said he saw it. He was the one that shattered it. And before we go too far, this is this whole being, when he says she has cast her lot with men and now she must be bound to one. That's our old friend. Remember last year when we were talking about Dionysus and the mysteries, and we talked about the principle of distribution. We talked about it in several ways. We talked about it, one in the many. That is to say that the further the divine projects itself into matter, the more the universality of the truth is lost, but it gets propagated into many discrete different meanings, so that by the time we get to the physical plane, everything is extremely complex, and it has so many different points of view and so many subjective outlooks that the truth has been multiplied, and each of those facts becomes a facet of the truth, wherein the whole truth is born through this partiality with a deeper kind of truth to it. Well, the other way we looked at distribution is the way that Brunhilde is looking at it. Now, we said that the unity of the spirit in this whole process of division could be propagated into many individual ones. Once the threefold spirit was possible, then many threefold spirits were possible, and that this had to be distributed with humanity, and this was the work of the threefold spirit from the transcendent to project the phenomenal, and that's what she has tied herself to. So he says she must sleep until a man awakens her. And she asks for and eventually secures the protection of an eternally blazing fire that no power can penetrate. So she is to be, so that no coward can penetrate, no one who has fear can penetrate. She said, if I'm going to be helpless, and the first person, the first human who sees me is going to claim me, I know you can't pick who it's going to be, because that has to be a free person. And you, in your limitations of the law, have now created something free, or given someone the opportunity for freedom, and they've taken it, and therefore you can't stick your nose in it. But at least you can protect me by setting up a condition that only someone who is not a coward can get through. You know, and so she is set up with a fire around her all the time. And this brings up an interesting point, another very big topic. There are so many big topics in these things that come up that I'm afraid I might be going into them too lightly and too shallowly and not touching on them at all. And I hope that it isn't the case to such an extent that you don't get interested in the ideas and think about the topics that we're only touching on here. Protection. Protection in terms of soul growth. It's like saying that it is for our own good that we are protected from seeing the Spirit, or from uniting with the Spirit too early, lest in our ways of weakness and our ways of temptation, we would take the agency of that and become horribly destructive, horribly malignant characters, and undo the work even further. And what is asked for here is a fire. In some ways, one could look at it as an etheric fire, as Buddha did when he said the whole world is on fire, that there's a living energy in all things. Or it could be a desire fire, because desire is the source of pain, even physical pain. We actually don't really even feel it in the physical. It's transmitted through the ethers into the desire body, and that's where we feel pain. But that is the thriving of desire, is in satiation, and in pain it is satiated, so that when people describe a hell-like condition as being in a perpetual fire, that is in the realization of a desire that burns in them, but a desire that burns in them that has no fruitful objective, that doesn't get anywhere, because desire is a very objective thing, and it is to lead us to some end. Or it could be the fire of pure spirit itself. Matter is kept alive by the driving agency of spirit. But at any rate, he grants it, and he kisses her goodnight. And she falls asleep, and he bids Loj to come and start a fire around her. Now, there are several kisses that take place in these operas. We're going to see a special kiss in the next opera in Siegfried. This is more like the kiss of sleep. This is not too distant from the kiss of Judas, or the kiss of the Mafia that means death, which is sleep's elder brother. It has to do with the last waking consciousness in the spirit falling asleep. Because we remember at one time in Lemuria, we used to be aware of our divinity in an innocent way. But when we were no longer innocent, we abused it. And we exiled our consciousness more and more into our personality. And it's sort of like turning a wheel. During the whole first half of the creation, it's called involution. And in that involution, everything is spinning forward, and it's like the time from third heaven until death in this life. Everything spins forward and consolidates more and more, and we get further and further away from the spiritual worlds, and we become more and more unconscious to them, and we become more and more ramified and developed in material existence. But before we can start spinning the other way and reverse the hardening process through death and decay or through spiritual unfoldment where we burn it up and pull out the soul material, the wheel has to come to a stop from its forward going before it can turn the other direction. And even if it is only for a moment, we have to lose the divine awakening in that innocent state, in that forward going innocent state, so that we can unfold it going the other way as a virtuous self-conscious power, where we spin the wheel out of our own volition, out of our own love. And so this stopping is what is represented by the spirit going to sleep on the rock. This is, again, we have, carries us back to one of the things that we saw in Heracles and we saw much earlier in Perseus. The woman, in this case, is not chained to the rock. The woman is asleep on the rock, and the beast is at the foot of the mountain, on the east side of the mountain, only he's not trying to eat her up. But the whole thing is here that this kiss is the kiss of sleep. It's the, she is carrying out now the godlike intent and is carried as far as it can go, and only someone who by their free will has clicked the spark can wake her up and can set the wheel spinning the opposite direction. Clearly, also, it is his presence that puts her to sleep, because she is now a changed being, because she has associated herself with the humans. And when that is the case, association with the higher living, the vibrant higher living, higher consciousness of the gods, has the effect of putting to sleep someone who is not of that level of living. I don't know how to say this. You know, like some people would find the music of Wagner very dull. It would put them to sleep, even though it's exceedingly exciting music, because it's so far over their head that it excites the spirit and it removes the spirit from the body, which is the only place that it has consciousness now, the rock, so to speak, and one goes to sleep. This is the reason why the disciples fell asleep in Gethsemane. It is because the cosmic Christ was contemplating and drawing power from within, from the ultimate divine deep within, to face that death in itself when it had the Judas kiss. And those vibrations or that life was so intense that it just pulled the disciple, the consciousness of the disciples right out of the body, and they fell asleep. Remember the two times that Jesus comes out of the garden, and that's what's involved here. So she falls asleep waiting the time of turning. And we can see that Wagner, in a sense, has looked at distribution in the same way as the Platonists did. He sees it as a punishment because we have lost our divine estate, And the punishment in this case is sleep rather than death. But there is something different here. There's a new element, and a new element that wasn't present in the Platonistic mysteries when we talked about them at the mysteries of the Eleusinian or the Bacchian, mysteries of Bacchus or the Orphic mysteries. And that is, there is a promise that a hero is going to come and awaken. So we have two very, very different points of view, and they're side by side. And this is sort of, you know, it's like there are two golden ages. Some in the Luciferian, in the Fafnirian sense, feel that the golden age was in the past, and there is a tendency to try to regress. With others, it's in the dreamy future, and there is a tendency to be preemptive. But in this case, there is a sleep that is between them, and we have the presence of a glorious past, which is now being punished in distribution, but also the promise of a glorious future, but that glorious future can only be won by the Son of the Faithful One, the Son of the Faithful One who has courage. And so we see the consciousness about the whole path of evolution relative to humanity itself is divided and broken into two parts like the sword itself is. Because we are like the sword, and we as human beings are also split. We're split between those of us who would live in the past and those of us who would live in the future, and the sword must be refused, and it must be refused by what Sigmund couldn't do. That is by having a wholehearted, a pure striving, a pure accepting of the challenge of life that will allow us to unify that which is divided and to keep us from regretting our past or being nostalgic about our past or dreaming about the future or being apprehensive about the future and all the terrible things that might happen any day now. It's only when somebody who can live right now and understand the presence of the eternal as it exists right now in each moment, as some people do when they're having a car accident or something like that, and they see all of the things happening in slow motion because their consciousness has been withdrawn into the divine, and in the divine they see the future coming to meet the present, but they're in the present in such a high state that they're strong enough to take the accident that they're going to have to take, which they need for their future development. So only one who can consciously put oneself into that now in such a way and reforge the two parts of the sword associated with the two views of the Golden Age can do it, and that's what comes up in the next opera. The most magnificent opera of all four of them, and the last act of Siegfried is probably one of the triumphs of any artist at any time. It's a stupendous work of art. And we'll start on, we'll probably try to do the first two acts next week and the third act the week following. See, now that you didn't have to worry about a tape, now you should have